Alright. Doors are closed, you're locked in.
Close enough. Let's get going. Start.
So, how's everyone's tech head so far? Wow, big party last night. Big party. Welcome to the first, I guess, Office 365 session. There was one previous to this. It's a bit more technical. So this is the looking at Office 365 as the future of productivity. My name is Ben Walters. I'm a technical specialist for Microsoft. I work with Office 365 day in, day out, based in Melbourne. And with me, I also have colleague Mike Mahoney.
Hi, Mike Mahoney. I'm from Redmond up in the Seattle area, and I'm a solutions architect. And I work to support Ben and the other technical sales specialists in Australia and the Northwest area in the U.S. for technical pre-sales, both disseminating information and bringing it back for customers and driving those changes into the product.
Okay. We should probably flip that over to our deck, otherwise this thing's just not going to change for the whole thing, is it? There we go. Beautiful. So, what we're here to talk about today is the future of productivity and looking at Office 365 and where that sits. And this is a scene-setting session, okay? So we're going to be going through what Office 365 is and give you a bit of an overview of where it sits and what it does. We have a whole bunch of follow-up sessions throughout the rest of TechEd that will go more in-depth on a lot of the topics we cover here today. So make sure when we get to the slide at the end that has the other follow-up sessions that you note those down and check those out. I will call out early, we have a session directly after this around identity management. So if you are wondering what to go to after this, wondering what a good follow-up session is definitely go straight from here to that session, and you'll get to see Mike talk again as part of that as well. So what are we covering today?
Hang on, before we jump in there, this is all Office 365. How many people have tried Office 365, have had a trial tenant or worked with the BPOS, the multi-tenant environment before?
Yeah, it's not too bad.
It's not bad.
It's not bad.
Okay, great.
Thanks. I've seen less hands when I've asked that question before. So look, what we're going to be talking about today, we're going to do a bit of a 101 on 365. We're going to have a look at what's changed between 365 and BPOS. We're also going to have a look at where that sits. One of the big questions when we look at cloud solutions is, hey, where does my data actually lie? Where is it actually being stored? And what effect does that have on my business? So we're going to have a look at that as well. And then we're going to go through each of the pieces of Office 365 individually and have a look at those a little bit closer, start to see what the changes are as part of that. Then we'll give you a bit of an idea of how you can get hold of it. We have some time at the end for questions as well, so hence why we've got some mic runners who'll go around and get those questions for us as part of that. So, Office 365. We launched Office 365, was it end of June?
June 28th, end of June.
And look, Office 365 is really about our new release of what is our cloud service. So, as we saw, some people out there have used BPOS before. BPOS was our... BPOS was our original cloud offering. It was based on our 2007 product suite. So we're looking at Exchange 2007, SharePoint 2007, and Office Communication Server. Office 365 is really about bringing those products that we have running in our cloud environment up to the most recent release of the same products you could get on-premise. So Exchange 2010, SharePoint 2010, and then from the IAM presence, the Lync side of things.
Okay, time out for one sec.
Okay, there's a lot of people standing up. Can you scoot over if there's a seat next to you? There's some seats up here, you guys. And then back in the corner over there. So come on in. We're almost at capacity. It's, you know, it's the Gold Coast. Let's have a friendly conversation.
So the last piece here is around Office. So we also add the Office client now as being able to purchase Office, that wonderful app we all love and use on our desktop, and purchase that as part of a subscription as well. So we can roll that all up as part of the offering that's available from the 365 perspective. So really changes the way we start to think about what we can do. Great thing about that is, you know what, these server products are awesome. They provide a lot of functionality and a lot of ways for us to work, but they're useless without a way for me to access them. So putting Office in that is really, really key. So, very high level here as to what's new in 365, and this is not an exhaustive list, so you know, don't feel like you have to memorize it, but there are some key things to look at as part of that. Now, we're going to go into each of these products in more detail, so again, don't stress that if you miss some of this, but you know, from an Exchange perspective, we're now running Exchange 2010, so we have all of the voicemail unified messaging pieces as part of that. A whole bunch of things around retention policies and legal hold that now light up as part of that, as well as the other great features of Exchange 2010, so mail tips and being able to work with policies around alerting people and those types of things. SharePoint is a really, really big step forward. How many people have used SharePoint online in BPOS? You can admit it. It's okay. Cool. SharePoint Online and BPOS had a pretty big feature gap between what we could do in the online world and what we could do with SharePoint on-premise. Been a lot of work done to reduce that feature gap, make it a lot more parity clear in regards to what we can do on-premise and what we can do online. And so that's really where a lot of the big changes have come from the SharePoint perspective. Link, big upgrade here from Office Communication Server for the IM presence, being able to see who's online, IM those people, start up voice calls and those types of things, and also video chats as well. And then from the Office side of things, big change here is specifically around the way you buy it. You know, yesterday you'd go and pay $400 or $500 for a copy of Office, and that was it, that was your copy of Office, and that's where it sat. Now as you're going on a subscription model, you're paying on a monthly basis, paying a lot less on a monthly basis, but also including any future releases of Office that come as part of that as we move forward throughout, as we go forward as well. And then as the platform overall, so the BPOS service or the cloud service overall, there's been some big changes. Fresh coat of paint on the user interface to make that look a lot nicer and a lot fresher. Additional work around role-based access, so not putting you in this position of only being able to assign administrators and users, you can now break those permissions down and start to provide a lot more granular detail to what people can do in the online service. And then a really, really big leap forward in the way we work with identity. So as we look into that, head straight on the other one. So identity for us was a really big thing. And in BPOS, we really had two options. The first was around using what we called online IDs. This was really great, awesome for small businesses who don't have an Active Directory server, don't have their own identity management. They could actually start and spin up a cloud service, have IDs and passwords managed online. Now, you know, with every pro comes a bit of a con, and in this case it was more around the fact of having two passwords. There was no idea of single sign-on in this just online ID world. There's also some other things around two-factor authentication in there as well, and no control over how those passwords and policies were applied to those IDs stored in the cloud. In BPOS, we had another option, which again still exists in the Office 365 world, was it's kind of a midway point here, still using an online ID, but syncing up a lot of that directory and those user accounts from your Active Directory online, still having now two passwords, so you have a domain password and you have an online ID password. And this is what was really what we saw in BPOS as being our enterprise kind of grade option for identity management. Wasn't the nicest thing, but it did provide some single sign-on with the addition of a Windows client and a couple of other things. 365, this again is still a midway point. You can actually have those online IDs with AD. But if you want the best experience, want your users to be able to log onto these services wherever they are, you really want to start to look at federated IDs and DirSync. And what this means is it provides a single sign-on experience. It means that it's one password for everyone to work with, makes it a lot easier to work through the environment without having to constantly re-enter credentials or manage two passwords. It also means that as an organization, you can manage the password policies that are set against that. So let's have a little bit of a closer look at how that federated or how these identity models work. So we look at online IDs. It's really about provisioning that ID in the cloud. Sits up there, the password sits in the cloud, and like I said, it's all applied by Microsoft from a security perspective. So our password expiry policies, our password complexity policies that we apply to that. So we said the next level up was around synchronizing those identities from Active Directory up to the cloud. But again, password still sits in the cloud as well. So you now have two IDs essentially. You have an AD ID and an online ID as well. And this is the midway point that we see, that where a lot of people were going for when we had BPOS. When we look at Office 365, you start to pull in this technology called Active Directory Federation Services to federate with the online environment. And this provides the ability for you to not only synchronize the IDs up, but when the user goes to authenticate, it actually talks directly back to your AD via that ADFS server to get that authentication mechanism. So now you're looking at managing those passwords on-premise, again, single password, single security policy to manage as part of that. And all of that authentication piece is maintained back internally as well.
Okay, before we jump on, I want to make sure, I want to just kind of review that for a second. So there's three methods of managing ID.
Why is that?
Thank you. There's three methods. We're going to go over these in details in the next session with Toby Knight and myself and wherever we are in SEC, the 300 series session next on identity. But you can manage identities in the online service by themselves. You can also use a DirSync to import those IDs from the local Active Directory to sync them up and maintain the synchronization. Okay, and then you can use the federation where you do that dirsync to activate the user IDs, but then you specify that they're federated and the authentication takes place via SAML with online Active Directory federation back at your own AD. Okay, so there's three different methods, and there's benefits of both or all three options, and it really depends on the complexity and how big the customer is that you're working with. So if you're a small to medium business, or small business, just IDs, you can manage it up in the cloud. If you're larger and you want to do a dirsync so you don't have to maintain management of the two environments, you establish dirsync. And then if you want that single sign-on experience, you do the federation, but it requires infrastructure. And we do a really good job. Toby has a nice set of decks in the identity session, so it'd be great to see you there to get into that.
Thanks, Mike. So the next thing we're going to touch on here is, where's my data stored? So as I said, when we start to look at a cloud service, you're taking a lot of data that day-to-day runs your business, and you're putting it somewhere else. Now, historically, you go to a hoster, that hoster's down the road, or they're in another state, and they're all in the country, and it's all great. When we look at cloud service, it's all about scale. It's about building this out and making it available for everyone worldwide. And so for Microsoft, what we've done is we've actually regionalized our data centers into three separate locations, US, Europe, and the APAC region. And so for each of those regions, we have geo-redundant data centers. So if we look at what that means for us in Australia, it means that our data centers are located in Singapore and Hong Kong, primary data center in Singapore with a backup in Hong Kong. And there's a lot of work that's done around the locations for those data centers. A lot of research and a lot of stuff goes into us actually before we break ground on creating that data center as to why we will put it there. So that takes into account things like government stability, tax reasons, what we can take advantage of in regards to environmental conditions as well. So for example, in Europe, we have our primary data center in Dublin. We actually take advantage of things like the cold air outside. We pipe that in over the servers so that we can actually use that to cool the environment rather than having to have all these nice big aircon running all the time as well. So we take a lot of these factors into the case when we start to provision these data centers. We also put a lot of money into this as well. So as you can see here, this is probably an older figure. It's probably gone up a little bit since then. But at the time of writing, we had roughly about $2.3 billion invested in our data center infrastructure alone. So this is not something that we kind of take lightly. It's not something we kind of spin up as a server under someone's desk in Redmond. Mike does not have the cloud running under his desk in Redmond. It doesn't get unplugged by the person doing the vacuuming, and Mike doesn't kick it, so it's all good, right? But we put a lot of work into that, and it's not just hardware infrastructure. Like, we don't get me wrong, we put a lot into the hardware specifically. We have servers that are custom built for Exchange from HP. We're one of the biggest purchasers of those servers to provide that scale to the rest of the world on that. But also on things like security, right? So we want to make sure that this environment that you're putting your data in is not going to be accessible to everyone who decides they want to walk up. So everything from the physical layer, so be that, you know, those cool nice little palm print scanners that, you know, give that nice little access granted as you walk into a data center, to, you know, things like dead man doors, stopping people trailing in behind people. There's a lot of work that goes into that and manages that. And so we take that very, very seriously as part of that.
These are the same data centers that Microsoft runs the rest of their enterprise services out of. So Hotmail, Live, the Bing, all the Bing servers, the services are in those same data centers. So, I mean, online service is a big piece of Microsoft, but it's actually pretty small when you're looking at the number of servers and the infrastructure that's in place for Bing and Hotmail and those other major services.
So we put a lot of work into this, and I guess the key thing around this is when we start to look at what it would take for, you know, another organization to spin up a data center like the level of data center we have in these carrier class data centers, be a lot of effort just to do that, to spin up your mail and run that mail service as effectively as we do. We also have a way of rating our data centers, which we have a power utilization ratio that we run at. I think the average is roughly about 2.6. It's basically power in versus compute power out. And that gives you a bit of an idea as to how much power you're consuming as to how much those processes are running. And I think last check we were about 1.6 for our power utilization ratio for those data centers.
It depends on the data center. But the newest ones are even lower than that.
So, yeah, and we continue to work on that and pull that down as part of that as well. So I guess the key thing around this takeaway from here is, you know what, we do a lot of work to make sure the data you're putting in that service is safe. We do a lot of work to make sure it's secure, and we know it's your data. We don't take ownership of that. We don't try and mine that or look at that in any way. It's your data. It sits in the service. We want to make sure we keep that secure and provide you the best service as part of that.
Before we go on. Okay, so we're at capacity here, and I don't know if the show people might want to stop people from coming in. The rest of you, you could work your way. There's some seats on this side over by Ram. And come around. Come on around. Hi. If we can turn the AC up, Wayne, I don't know if you can fix that. That'd be awesome.
Pat the person next to you. Pull out your little book.
Oh, that's so helpful. Thank you very much.
Beautiful. Okay, so with that, let's take a closer look at the services overall. I'm actually going to hand over to Mike now to take us through the Exchange Online service specifically and start to look at that in detail.
Thanks. There's still a couple seats over there if you want to. We'll pause. Come on over. I'll pause for a sec. You won't miss anything. And while we're doing this, are there any general questions about the overview of Office 365, you know, the direction of where we're going? Any questions to start off with? In the back there?
Thank you, Mike.
That's a great question. The question is, do we have any plans for Australian-based data center? We've gone around discussing that several times. We understand there's data sovereignty issues, not just with Australia, but a lot of other countries. We're continuing to evaluate that. I cannot tell you yes or no at this point, but we are evaluating it. Okay, so the question is, what are the implications of U.S. Patriot Act laws on where the data is stored? So first of all, if you purchase Office 365 from here, your data is going to be in Singapore and Hong Kong. Okay, it's regional-based data center based on where you're located and where you purchase the service. So Patriot Act laws primarily, you know, they apply to the U.S.-based data centers. And there's some opinions written, not just by Microsoft, but some other folks that I would really refer you to. We can follow up if you get a hold of your TSP like Ben here. But in a lot of cases, most companies are subject to the same Patriot Act laws, whether we host your data center in the U.S. or not, just because that company may have operations within the U.S. So it's a very detailed discussion that we should have there.
There are also other, just on that as well, there are also reciprocal rights between governments that potentially come into play as part of that.
Right.
So, you know, when we start to look at where the Patriot Act lies and where they can start to take, you know, I guess swing their bat around and say we want data, is they can actually come to the Australian government and as part of their agreement, they will talk. And that's part of the agreements between governments in working together. So.
Here first. Sorry.
In Australia, we have the Unified Privacy Principles. Is Microsoft engaging with the Australian government at all and addressing the issues that we were faced by storing our data in Singapore?
So the question is, does Microsoft engage with the Australian government in understanding the privacy laws and what would be required by storing the data within Singapore and Hong Kong? Yes, actually, on several levels. Last year, we hosted a group of Australian government agencies as well as APRA, in the U.S. with my security and compliance team. And we went through the entire presentation. We looked at our controls. And their laws. We are continuing that discussion with them.
So. You mentioned earlier that SAML is supported for federated access or federated authentication. Is that Microsoft SAML or is that Open Standards SAML, so Noble Access Manager and those sorts of things?
Okay, good question. The question is, we use SAML for Active Directory Federation, and is that open standards? Can you use any SAML authentication source? Today, we federate with Active Directory Federation Server. We use SAML 1.1, and that's where it is today. In the future, not sure where that's going to be or how open that's going to be, but we do have Active Directory. We do have, that is our source for Microsoft as a company. So you'll have to just keep your eyes open on where we go. Customer feedback, you know, market demand will lead us to broaden that. Okay. Do two more, and then we'll get going here. Question here?
Yeah, just a quick question regarding data centers again. I just came back from the presentation where they're saying the best latency you can get is from the data centers in Central South America. So when you say that you can only host Like we've got the option of hosting our stuff on in Hong Kong / Singapore. Could we also opt for South America data centers or
in South America?
Yeah.
So
Central America, I'm not sure whereabouts is that.
Okay. Let me back up to
so, one. So our American region data centers are based in Washington and Chicago. So it's not South America. So it'll be a North America data center for that. I'll let you talk about the actual location side of things, of requesting locations specifically.
Yeah, so the real question is around latency, okay? Singapore, Hong Kong is a long way from here, and so is the United States. Chicago and actually San Antonio is where we're hosted out of in the U.S. So sometimes you get better latency out of going to the U.S. than Singapore. So the question is, can you change the location? I'm just going to say maybe, okay? By default, we're pretty specific about where you sign your contract is where you're going to put your data, okay? But I will say at the same point, I mean, we're talking about Exchange here next. The Exchange user experience, the Outlook user experience on Office 365 worldwide is pretty darn good, no matter where your data source is. Okay, I travel the world. My data is sitting out in San Antonio. And with cache mode in the Outlook 2007, 2010 client, it's a pretty good user experience. Most of the end users will not notice a big change like that. Now, if you're sending a 10 meg file to the guy sitting right next to you and it's got to go all the way up there and then all the way back, yeah, you're going to see it. But day-to-day operations, most of your end users aren't going to experience it. Okay, SharePoint's a different story. So we've got to look at the workloads and where you're going to put up there. Link online, the majority of the link online work is peer-to-peer. So yeah, you get your contact list and your free busy and that information from the data source. But most of your conversations are peer-to-peer, and that's just a good experience, too. So there's really only one workload where that's in effect. Okay? And we'll do one last question. If there's one more question that you're just dying to ask right now, we'll take that. Otherwise, we'll jump into Exchange. Right here. How are the data centers supported? Oh, what do you mean in support? Oh, okay. So our data center, the question is, how are the data center operated, really? And I will tell you, you should go to globalfoundationservices.com. Okay, that's Microsoft's GFS, Global Foundation Services, data center group. And they operate the network and data centers for all of Microsoft properties. So they're running these servers and these facilities for the online group. They also run it for Bing. We are their customers, okay? These are complete headless data centers. I mean, we have a group of people that are there 24/7 for hardware break fix, for security, for racking and stacking and managing the networking. And that's it. And they manage it in an ISO 27001-2 certified data center capacity. They have their SAS 70. They're very rigorous. They have their processes, and it's a very secure environment. Everything else about the service is run remotely. So everything, I mean, there's probably a dozen people there that you would see, and two of them would be the ones escorting you through the data center on the tour. So everybody else is just managing break fix, hardware setup, and tear down. Okay? All right, well, let's talk about Exchange Online. I need a drink first. Okay. Exchange Online, Office 365 Exchange Online is based on the 2010 product. It's using the data center SKU, the data center version. So there's other capabilities you get with the service that you wouldn't have on premises. It allows us to scale and manage tenants separately. Okay, it is the same data source for all clients. You've got a single data source for your mobile access, for Outlook web access, and for the rich client. Depending on where you get to it, you're accessing the same set of data. Outlook runs in cache mode. That's how we prefer you do that. Okay. It doesn't have to. You can connect in direct connect mode, but then you really have to worry about that latency issue that we have. Okay. By default, every user gets 25 gigabytes of capacity, except there are different SKUs. You can buy it where you're a deskless user or if you're a standard information worker user. The IW users get 25 gig, and you can purchase archive. So you can get 25 gig and then unlimited archive, or you can get 25 gig, which includes the personal archive. It depends on how you want to go about purchasing that. Okay, so that could be a whole lot of capacity. And then it can bring up all kinds of legal discovery and e-discovery issues, and we'll talk about that pretty soon. We have hosted voicemail. This is new for Office 365 on the 2010 platform. You can integrate it with your voicemail environment so that you can have, you know, just click on your voicemail. It actually translates the text for you from the voicemail, which is always entertaining if you've ever had that on premises. You say, well, that's not what I heard, but there it is. So there's some functionality there that you can remove off of your PBX into the hosted environment and give your mobile users a lot more capacity, flexibility in their work days. Okay, everything with the Exchange Online comes with the antivirus and anti-spam. Anti-spam, let me start with anti-spam, is from FOPI, the Forefront Online Protection for Exchange. That's the cloud-based service that you can buy on-premise, just like a Message Labs or Prostini. Or by default, you get it with Office 365. Okay, that does the anti-spam, and it matches up very well with all the competitors in the cloud environment. On the server side, is where we do the antivirus. So we don't do AV up in the cloud in FOPI. We do it within our server environment so that between tenants and between users, I can manage all my antivirus there too. So we're pretty well covered. And that's a standard feature. It comes with the price of the SKU that you purchase for every user. Okay. What's new with Office 365 over the BPOS, the old multi-tenant space, is the interface with FOPI is built into the admin console. It used to be a separate admin console. You'd have to log into 365. You'd have to log into FOPI to manage it, to set up your AV filtering and your the forcing TLS per domains and all that good stuff. So now it's one nice user interface. It's a big improvement. Like Ben was saying, you know, they put a new skin on it, they painted it pretty, and it's actually a lot more usable.
Probably cut more builds.
How many builds do we have to? Okay. The Exchange Control Panel, it's not just a new pretty face. Okay, there are a lot more functionality with the new 2010 control panel. You manage all your users. You can do it directly through the UI, or you can use PowerShell to create users, distribution groups, manage it, manage role-based access and all your policies. You can create active sync policies through and assign them to individual users. It's a huge improvement over the BPOS setup. So definitely would encourage you to go look at that functionality. The online help and the documentation is a large step forward with Office 365. There's a lot there. I mentioned PowerShell. The PowerShell functionality has really come a long way too. There's a nice set of documentation in online help that describes what you can do. You can apply policies on a per user basis, all through PowerShell, and create users, move mailboxes, assign users to archive. It's really a good functionality. Role-based access control. Customers really beat us up over this, and it was definitely a limitation with Office or the BPOS environment. You used to have one or two admins, and that was it. They could do everything. So now we have role-based access control. It's built in just like the 2010 on-premises server, so you can split it up so that you have the company admin, you have a help desk role with different functionality, and you have like a discovery admin. So you, with the multi-mailbox search capability for e-discovery, you can assign that role to a specific person and then give that person rights to a subset of all your mailboxes. so that they can actually go out and do the searches themselves instead of just having the admin. It's a good piece of functionality for eDiscovery. And by the way, your administrators don't have access to it by default, okay? They don't have the ability to go out and do multi-mailbox search on somebody's mailbox by default. You have to give them that role. The fact that you gave them that role is an auditable event. So on this slide, I'm showing you all the new reports that we have. With 365, this is fantastic. Customers have been, you know, needed this for a long time. So you have the ability to look at who's accessed my mailbox that are not owners. So if my admin is touching somebody's mailbox, you know about it now. If Microsoft's admin touches your mailbox, you're gonna see it right here. So as far as data sovereignty, I mean, who's touching my mail, data privacy, this is a really good report, and it goes a long way to help customers and you feel more secure about your data being up in the cloud. Role-based access. Everything as far as role-based access and the audit controls are logged and reported here. So you can see the litigation hold, the admin role group report. When you go out and change a certain policy, the changes is applied here, and it's audited, and you can report it. So it gives your compliance department a lot more control than we used to have. It's a big step forward there. Hopefully you'll like it. We'll continue on this. We'll improve these reports over time. And we'll look forward for your feedback to help us make that a complete picture. Okay, so equally as important as what is available is what's not available. Believe it or not, I don't want you to buy the service and get out there and go, oh God, I didn't know you couldn't do that. Because that's a horrible experience. And that just causes problems and migrations, delays, and et cetera. So here's what's not available. And I want to spend some time on this. This is pretty important. Client access. All right, 2003 of Outlook is not available. Okay, 2007 and 2010 and above. That's pretty important. We're not going to change that. Outlook Web Access, BlackBerry. Okay, so how many BlackBerries in the group? All right. A lot of customers use BlackBerries. Today, we are not offering it as part of the Office 365 environment. You may know RIM is developing a cloud-based service that will connect and you can subscribe to use with Office 365. In the BPOS environment, we hosted the servers. Not a really good scalable solution for us, nor for RIM. So that's a service that's in development. There's a beta going on right now. We're expecting that to be public beta in October, November, release early part of next calendar year. Okay. So if you have BlackBerries, you won't be able to provision them or use them in the Office 365 environment until that's done. Okay. But you can use Exchange ActiveSync for free. So all your Windows mobile devices, your iPhones, or anything that uses ActiveSync, bring it on. All right, directory. We do not have hierarchical address books. Okay, not such a big deal down here. It's a huge deal in the Japanese and Asia, North Asia market. There's no change in address book segmentation. So it's functionality you can implement on premises. It's not something we have available today. It's probably a Wave 15 of Exchange service, okay? Voicemail, where you can call up and have voicemail read back to you, or you can work through your email, and those features aren't completely baked into the service today. So that's not available. Application developers, there's some pretty important things here. Public folders, I hope everybody knows public folders weren't included. They haven't been for some time. MAPI CDO access is just not there. If you're developing anything that interfaces with Exchange, you need to be doing Exchange Web Services. Okay, EWS is the future for us, and that's where all of our development is going to happen, so please be there.
I think keeping around that, too, is that the reason that's not there is it's a security thing. Right, we want to make sure that stuff's not getting onto the servers, onto that Exchange environment that's not, you know, vetted and checked and all those types of things. We want to make sure we can provide this service to everyone who's there, and that it's not just one customer who's gone and put up a, you know, hastily put together piece of code that then pulls down the environment. So it's not about us wanting to cause problems. It's about us wanting to make sure we can provide this service to everyone the same way.
Now, the RIM Bez uses MAPI, right? And they're converting it to EWS. So they're going to do Exchange Web Services over the internet to connect to us. That's how the service is going to be developed. Nothing can be installed on the servers. Obviously, it's a cloud-based service, so if you have something in an application that needs to have a control or a DLL on the server, it's not going to work. So if you're doing any development, keep all that in mind, please. All right, administration. We had a bunch of discussion about data centers. By default, you're going to be provisioned in Singapore and Hong Kong. You don't have the ability to pick which data center. I can flop you from one data center to another because we run active-active, and I can move you in the background. This is a cloud service, okay? So that's what you should expect. We do publish IP addresses and URLs in our help so that if you have access control at your edge, you can manage that more specifically. But we do recommend doing it based on URLs, okay? Outlook.com/whatever. That's where you should set your permissions. Archiving and compliance. Multi-mailbox search. I mean, you can export to PSTs using PowerShell. Okay, SMIME. Today, DirSync doesn't support synchronizing your SMIME certificate from your directory into the online environment. There are ways of making it work, but it's really not a scalable solution. So RMS, a rights management service from Microsoft, is integrated. It works very well. So if you're looking at that, that's a better solution for us in this environment. Yes, question?
Can you just clarify what you mean by PC files? Is that available or not? Is it on the site? It's not available.
Yeah, it says not available. It's available through PowerShell. It's not available through a UI. So. In multi-mailbox search, your search ends up in a discovery mailbox. It's just like on-premises Exchange 2010 discovery mailbox. And from there, you can export it to a PST using PowerShell. You just can't. There's no UI to do it today.
Where does it store it when you do that?
It's another mailbox up in the cloud. So we create a 50-gig discovery mailbox, or you can, actually. Through PowerShell, you can create multiple. You do your search, you specify which discovery mailbox for it to end up in. And we do the search, we dump all the mail in there, and then you can export it from there.
It enumerates that PST into a mailbox, but if you want to get hold of that PST file.
Well, so it's an online mailbox, it's not a PST until you copy it locally.
Yes.
Okay.
Right. So you're exporting it, how do you actually get that PST from the cloud?
Yeah, it's a PowerShell command. So. Yeah, I'm sorry, Reb. So the question is really about the multi-mailbox search capability. Exchange 2010 has the ability to do a multi-mailbox search through the admin control panel. You search to, from, date range, keywords, and you specify the discovery mailbox. Discovery mailbox is a special mailbox that cannot be added to or deleted from in any other way. So you can't send mail to it, and it keeps the discovery consistent for, you know, e-discovery purposes, right? Chain of custody, etc. Well, that mailbox is just like a user mailbox up in the cloud. It's up there. You do your search. In the back end, we dump the data to that mailbox. So your mailbox is up there. The discovery mailbox is there. Connect to PowerShell. You export it to a local PST file. Okay. And that's Exchange. So I'm going to pause for a second for Exchange questions. How are we doing?
Not too bad, I think.
Okay. Question in the back.
When Office 365 first came out, just as well as going to let that first. Office 365 first came out, there was some discontinuity in the documentation about the maximum size of a message. It seemed to vary between 20 megabyte and 35 megabyte, depending on the relative positions of the sun and moon.
The maximum attachment size is 25 meg. That is correct. The fluctuation was they wanted to provide 25 meg attachments. I hope everybody heard that. So the question is, what's the maximum attachment size? Because during the beta, it actually fluctuated a bit. You know, right before release, they almost said 35 meg. But when you attach a when you attach something, it gets encoded. The encoding brings it over that 25 meg. So the maximum message size is 25 meg. In the back end, we honestly have it a little higher so that to take care of that encoding, okay? But the documentation now says 25 meg.
But in practice, it's like 26, 27 to allow for the
overhead. Exactly. Okay. Question over here. Okay, that's a good question. The question is, with SMTP applications setting up, they can set up a relay to go through to the cloud. Before I answer it directly, you need to be aware of the limitations on recipients. Okay, we have recipient limitations of 1,500 recipients per user per day. So if you have an application that spams, this is not your platform. You need to maintain an SMTP source on-premises that actually distributes to the internet. Okay, this is really set up to keep users or keep our tenants from having one user blacklist themselves. Okay, it also protects us because we're running a multi-tenant environment. We want to be able to have that environment up for all of our customers and provide a good user experience. The answer there is you can have applications that send. They need to authenticate using SMTP with a user account that's defined in the environment. Okay. One question here, then I'll come back there, and then we'll move on. Okay.
It's around journaling. Basically, are there any plans in place to allow journaling to your own stores? So if you've got 50 users, you want one journaling mailbox. At the moment, you've got to host it somewhere else, somehow.
Right. Okay, so the question is, you could set up journaling, and now we actually have a fantastic UI for establishing transport rules, and that's where you would set up your journaling transport rule. You can say to and from these users, you know, you journal it off to this SMTP mailbox. Now, the real question that was asked is, can that mailbox be a cloud-based service within my own tenant? The answer to that is no. We're not going to do that anytime soon. Normally, you set up journaling so that you can, for discovery purposes, the destination mailbox must be an external SMTP mailbox from what we're hosting up in the cloud for you. Okay? And final question? Actually, okay, I'm sorry. I did it to you. Go ahead, back there.
So you're thinking about mail to SharePoint list? So the question was, there's no agents, there's no list integration. Correct. You can't do mail to a SharePoint list from the SharePoint environment. You can do alerting, so you can get the alert emails back out from SharePoint, but you can't say send to SharePoint list.
Okay, and the last one here. Sorry.
Just quick one regarding, there's some thing about having on-site, a mix of on-site exchange and cloud. How does that work as far as licensing and integration?
Okay, so the question really is, we have a question about this hybrid coexistence. We call it rich hybrid coexistence, where you're basically extending the cloud environment, exchanging the cloud with your on-premises environment. Do we have an exchange detailed session?
We do.
This week?
So there is a session later on today as well, also with Toby Knight, which Great. Is around exchange migration and going from a simple environment to a rich coexistence environment, so a hybrid environment, and looking at what the setup is for that. From a licensing perspective, I don't think he'll cover that off, but it will definitely from a technical perspective of the way they integrate, he'll cover that off in a lot of detail and set that up. So definitely recommend you check out that session.
So I'll make a quick statement about licensing, and then I'll caveat it by saying we're technical guys. We don't like to talk about licensing because we get in trouble. But basically, when you activate a user online, that's when you apply a license to them. Okay? If you've got somebody on-premises and you're in that rich coexistence environment, they've got to have an on-premises Exchange Cal. So you've got the online license and the on-prem Exchange Cal. Okay?
Sorry, that's actually incorrect.
That's incorrect?
Yeah, if you have an online Cal, you actually get the right to use the on-premise Exchange server.
Correct. However, if you provision, let's say you have Mike and myself, and you have Mike provisioned in the Exchange on-premise server, and that's where he sits, he would be using an on-premise CAL. If you provision myself in the cloud environment, and then decide, you know what, for the purposes of this project, we're pulling Ben back to an on-premise server for that period of time for whatever reason, then yes, that access license I have up here will transfer back. But if you're looking at the two environments specifically, you can mix and match those licenses. What I would also say is there is a bunch of licensing guys sitting on the showroom floor who will be able to take you through this in depth. So if you have those questions and they know the black magic, know the art, they sacrifice the chickens regularly, all that kind of stuff to figure it out, definitely head over to those guys and they will take you through it in depth and you'll be enlightened, I'm sure.
See, that's why I don't answer licensing questions. Okay, on to SharePoint.
All right, so on to SharePoint. So look, like I said, SharePoint has come a long way since what we had in BPOS. We've done a lot to ensure that the feature gap between the two has reduced significantly. And there's been a lot of new things that have come up as part of that. I guess one of the big challenges with SharePoint is what I like to call a scattergun product, right? It wants to solve everyone's problem in the exact way they want to do it. It's trying to be everything to everyone. And so when we look at saying this nice big platform product, how do we put that into the cloud? There are a lot of challenges with that, and especially when we look at the way it's been extended and built upon today in an on-premises environment. And so when we look at SharePoint Online, I guess my view of this is that you really start to look at what workloads make sense in the cloud, first of all. And so if we look at those that we've got up on screen at the moment, you know, starting with My Sites. My Sites is a great one. The number of times, so prior to joining Microsoft, I was a SharePoint consultant, and the number of times I would go into a customer site and say, there's this great thing called My Sites, and people can store their documents there, and it'll make things great, and they can be socially interactive, and all these kind of things, and they go, that's cool, that's awesome, it looks great. Now, how do we turn that off? We don't want to pay for storage for that. We don't want to have these people, you know, dumping all their stuff in SharePoint and their My Site. How do we do that? So putting a My Site in the cloud is brilliant, because as you provision those licenses up there, or you provision those users in the cloud, they get 500 meg allocated. It is their storage just for a My Site. It's not pooled. It's part of just their storage for their My Site. So a great way to keep that scale and not have to worry about all this storage that you scale up in your SQL server locally. That's a really great workload to put up there. Team sites and collaborations is another really good one. And with this, I'd probably turn around and say, you know what, these are those transient team sites that spin up for a period of time and then spin down as part of that as well. So one of the things with SharePoint, you know, we're all starting to learn today, and I know Microsoft, we learned this lesson really hard when we first deployed SharePoint, is around governance. You know, most times when we start to spin up project sites, they have a lifetime, they spin up for a period, and they spin down at the end of that, right? So this is where this is great, because you can burst up that scale, not have to worry about, oh, you know, is SharePoint going to need another 25 gig of RAM to spin up those extra 25 sites, or what are we going to have to do around that? So really great way to be able to keep that scale and keep that spinning up and down. Intranet sites is another great one, and the big benefit we get here is around having an intranet that is now accessible from anywhere. That single source of communication to the organization you have out there, you know, the CEO's blog and the, you know, all those kind of big comms that are going out, it's great to put in an online environment, because now you have the ability to keep that, you know, have that accessible anywhere. So if someone's, you know, on the road, working mobile, they still have the ability to access that, and you don't need all of that edge infrastructure sitting in place to be able to get back to an internal environment. They don't need to VPN in, they're coming in via the internet, it becomes much easier to access that. The last one here around making your business available on the internet and a public-facing website. I'm going to caveat this. This is what we have here is the ability to do what is a public-facing internet site. It is internet presence, and it is suitable for a small business. This is not a replacement for SharePoint for internet. Okay, so you're not going to get a nice big e-commerce portal set up on this. You're not going to get this big, wonderful website. This is about having an internet presence for those smaller businesses that simply having, you know, a site on the internet for them is the biggest achievement in the world. And being able to do that really easily and quickly is something that is important to them. It has a great WYSIWYG editor to be able to edit that and work with that, and that's the way you work with that site. So I really want to caveat that. It is great for that small business environment. If you're looking at a big enterprise, it's probably not going to suit as well, and you're going to end up banging your head against the door as part of that. So just make sure you slot that in the right spot. From an administration perspective, we're looking at a multi-tenant environment, which means administration changes a lot for SharePoint. You know, again, SharePoint consultant, so I'm quite happy to say that as a SharePoint dev in past, I was very, very spoilt, as most SharePoint devs are today. We always say we want admin access, and we want access to the server to deploy code, and I'll touch on the code thing later on. And generally speaking, we'd always get it. So when we're looking at a multi-tenant environment, giving a whole bunch of SharePoint devs full admin rights to a multi-tenant environment, you can see there's probably going to be some issues starting to come up as part of that. So we really looked at the way we manage administration for that. So we have a SharePoint Online Administration Center. This is a sub-administration area as part of the Office 365 tenant. It's where you manage everything for SharePoint: site collections, resource allocation, storage allocation, your InfoPath form services proxy, taxonomy building, and profile store. And then you have the Online Admin Center, and this is the overall overarching admin center that sits up where you manage the service as a whole. Now, you'll get to see these as a session first thing in the morning tomorrow morning called Zero to Productivity, and we will take you through the setup of this and show you exactly what this looks like. But just know that there are two admin centers that you may hear bantied about as part of that. From an admin perspective, where you lie as a user is in this tenant administration piece, right? So when we look at a tenancy, you know, it's really the best analogy here is looking at a rental property or a big apartment building. You get an apartment, you're responsible for that apartment. You're not responsible for getting someone in to connect the water to that entire building, you're responsible for your apartment. Same thing happens here. Microsoft takes care of the farm, we take care of the central admin for that service, and you as the person, the consumer of that service, you get access to that tenant level admin. And so that's where that SharePoint administration comes in as part of that. So, trust me, you'll be able to get access to these slides. There won't be a test at the end, you don't need to memorize all this. But this is a really good way of illustrating where the feature gaps lie from a SharePoint Online perspective. Everything in the green is what you can do in the online world. Everything in the red is either not available or is currently scoped for future release. So rather than going through all the green, which will take a long time, I'm going to go very quickly through some of the things that aren't available and just give you a bit of an idea why. Web analytics is the first one. We're looking at this, we're working on this. The team are currently looking at the best way they can provide that analytics data back out. Not there at the moment because trying to track that effectively is really difficult in a multi-tenant service. They want to make sure that they're getting that right data out before people start facing business decisions on that analytics data. From a content perspective, looking down at Word Automation Services and Record Center, this is a lot more around setting up specific records, and record centers aren't available. Word Automation Services requires code on the server to be able to take advantage of that. And so for that reason, we're not going to allow that to execute on the server. Again, looking at ways we can extend this moving forward with both service updates and future releases is where a lot of these features are going to start to get addressed. Search, fast search is a big one. How many people here have used fast search? Cool. So fast search as a product is not multi-tenant aware, which means if you're sitting on the service and your competitor is sitting on the service and you're searching, all of a sudden you're going to start to see each other's data. So as you can see, it's probably a bit of a problem, and we don't want to put Fast on there at the moment. So that's why Fast is not available as a search service on the server. Again, team is looking at that and looking at making that multi-tenant aware. Insights is probably the one that has the biggest gap at the moment, and this is really about business intelligence and pulling data from your line of business applications. And so if I was to turn around to you and say, hey, we're Microsoft, we're spinning up SharePoint Online for you. By the way, can you just give us a trusted connection back into your data, your SAP, your Oracle, your SQL data to do line of business reporting? You'd probably turn around and tell me where I could put my line of business reporting in the online environment. So this is why we don't currently have insights, a lot of these insights stuff available. So around data connection libraries, performance point is a really big one that's pulling data from those line of business apps to pull that into the online world. Business Intelligence Center and Chart Web Part are also things that we're currently working on to make that available. From the composite app side of things, business connectivity services and SharePoint timer jobs are the big ones not available there. Again, BCS around connecting to line of business data is not available. I know they are looking at this as part of future releases very soon. That'll hopefully come out as part of that as well. And SharePoint timer jobs, again, we're looking at something, functionality there that sits at the central admin level, not the tenant admin level, which is why that's currently not available. So when we look at where those feature gaps lie, it's actually pretty small when you look at the overall functionality of SharePoint. And all of this stuff is in place to protect the service and protect the people on that service. So again, it's not something we're just switching off to be a nuisance. So what does that mean? If we look at those feature gaps, how can we make the best deployment of SharePoint? And honestly, my view of this is that we have what we see as a very flexible way of deploying SharePoint. You can do SharePoint on premises, you can do SharePoint online, or you can do what is the sweet spot, which is coexistence. So being able to have those line of business apps running on a smaller SharePoint footprint internally, but still being able to put that scalable stuff that you want to be able to spin up and down and burst and my sites, et cetera, in the cloud and have that rich coexistence between the two. Now, coexistence is, and hybrid SharePoint is kind of a kind of a funny term because, let's be honest, there's no real communication between the two SharePoint servers. You have a URL here and you have a URL here. be brutally honest, the only way a user is going to know they've transitioned from an online world to an on-premise world is if the branding's different, which is something that would probably come up if you don't put that effort into the online service. That being said, you can do all that kind of branding, SharePoint Designer, Master Pages, Silverlight, prettiness that you want to keep that same feel and brand between the online world and the on-premise world, so that's a very seamless experience for the user. This is where the sweet spot sits for SharePoint today, and this is where I'd say if you're looking at it, look at what workloads you can put into the cloud to take advantage of that. So, extensibility side of things, we really scale up from green to red in areas of difficulty and where it sits. Configuration out of the box, this is where it starts. This is where a lot of your users will play who aren't tech savvy, who don't have a lot of play, who don't tend to want to fire up SharePoint Designer or Visual Studio. You have access to the web parts, standard out of the box workflows, create site templates, build sites with lists and libraries. This is all the standard out of the box stuff. It's all still there. It's still just SharePoint Online in essence, right? You're not having some weird, bastardized version of SharePoint, dare I say it, that has all these strange functionality. It is SharePoint 2010. You have the ribbon, you have all that there to work with. Stepping up, you get SharePoint Designer. You can still connect with SharePoint Designer. You can still do all that branding side of things in that. Take advantage of no-code workflows, authoring workflows in Visio, which I have to ask, who's actually used Visio to author a workflow and push it in? It's getting less and less each time. So those guys, two guys at the back, let them evangelize to you on how cool that is. But being able to take a workflow designed in Visio that a business user could put together for you, push that into SharePoint Designer, assign actions to it, and then push it up to the online environment is a really, really great way to start and pull up some of those business automation processes. You still have access to the master page and the site templates, and you can start to build those and customize those as needed. Now, when we look at the technical side of things, when we get all the way down into the techie side of things, what can we do? So from a development perspective, you can still use Visual Studio to build sandbox solutions. So we don't have access, like I said, to deploying stuff on the server. This is really key because part of this is, that, again, around us trusting your code and making sure you're not going to pull down the server, start accessing other things on the server that you probably shouldn't have access to. So you can deploy solutions as long as they sit within that sandbox environment and are accessing data as part of that. Yes? So the question was, where in this model does third-party web parts being supplied by vendors fit? So it depends on the way that web part is built. If that web part requires a DLL deployed to the server, which historically you could probably say 90% of the time does, that won't work in the online environment. Now that being said, I have seen a lot of those, like Bamboo Solutions and those vendors that just focus on their bread and butter is web parts are now starting to look at ways they can do those, either move those web parts from being fully trusted code solutions to sandbox solutions, or they're looking at other ways that they can start to create cloud-based web parts. So, and I call it out because I know I've played with them a little bit. Bamboo, for example, have specific cloud web parts that they are working with and starting to provide as part of that. So in those instances, if it's a web part that you absolutely must have, you'll need to put that in a site in the on-premise world if it's not going to get changed. Other than that, we'll check with your ISV and see if they've got plans to make that cloud capable. So coming back to these sandbox solutions, you've also got access to Silverlight and the client object model, and you can hit the SharePoint web services as part of that as well. So there are ways, in theory, to scooch around the not being able to access anything outside your site collection that the sandbox solution imposes, and you can do that through the client object model effectively and do a call out. I will say, there was a session prior to this one from Chris Johnson that was looking at that. If you missed it, definitely get in and see if you find the recording and have a look at that. Chris Johnson built this great app around connecting from SharePoint Online to Azure. So definitely if you get a chance, have a look at that one and check that out. And we'll have the code up for that later on as well. So that brings us to the end of the SharePoint side of things. I'll pause as well and just see if there's any other questions that people want to throw out as part of that before we move on to the Link Online piece. Yeah. Correct. So the question was just confirming, no, we can't email to a list in SharePoint Online. So honestly, I'm not sure where the product team lies on the email to SharePoint list in where we've seen on that. Not sure off the top of my head. Catch up with me later and I'll see what we can follow up if there's something that we know about that. I've not seen it sit on a feature list anywhere just yet, but not sure.
Security can provide control that only people really want have access to that.
question is around how do we secure the admin portals, essentially, and how do we ensure that? I'm going to hand that over to Mike. I'm going to let him go from the server side of things.
Is the question specifically around SharePoint or in general?
Well, the Exchange Online admin, the SharePoint admin, I know the Azure one, don't like it. Don't know what it's like for the Office 365.
Okay.
So with the question is about the administration model and rights for all of the different services within the online Office 365 environment. Basically, you end up with role-based access, and then from there you have more specific requirements. So you've got a couple of different admins, and then in Exchange, you have the different RBAC roles that you can apply out there. Is that not the question?
Yeah, so is that something do I hit a website, or hit a portal, and log in by username and password, and I'm in?
Yes.
Two-factor authentication?
Yeah. So when you first sign up the tenant, you will get a base admin account, and that is you're hitting the Office 365 portal and you're putting the creds for that admin. Now, the authentication model behind that is in Azure, it's the Live ID that you're using. In this, it's built off the same infrastructure or the same physical authentication architecture, but it was taken from Live, used as the base, and built up for 365. So it is not a Live ID, it is an online services ID only. So that is your when you first sign up. One ID with one password, and then if you look at, you start to synchronize those users up from Active Directory Federation services, you can assign them the admin rights you want as part of that as well.
Right. So initially, there is a primary tenant admin, and then from there, once you do your synchronization, you bring your accounts on, or you create them additional accounts, you can give them admin roles, et cetera, and go from there. So I would encourage you to go to the identity session, which is next, but as far the question was, are there ways to add multi-factor identification? So in the MockP, the online environment, no. All right, the tenant admin goes up there, you're going to specify your UPN and your password, and that's it. Okay. All the other users, if you're using a federated identity, then we will redirect that user back to your federated Active Directory, and then you can control more or less your access there. SharePoint questions.
Yeah. How can I deploy the customizations that I did for Visual Studio to the SharePoint environment?
So the question is, how can I deploy the customizations that I've done through Visual Studio? And I'm going to assume it's in a sandbox solution or a site template, something along those lines, to the online environment. So when we're developing with a Visual Studio against SharePoint, you will develop against a local copy of SharePoint, so a dev server or something along those lines to do that. Once you've done that, you can build that up as a SharePoint solution and deploy that to the solution gallery and have that coming in as part of a feature activation or a site template to push that through. So, I'm going to hold that question because we have a slide that addresses that specifically right at the end. It'll hopefully outline that for you on the way that works. So, what I'll do is I'll come back to you specifically then, and if it hasn't answered your question, then we'll cover off in more detail there. Yeah.
Is that being done through GUI or can you use PowerShell?
So the question is the admin all done through PowerShell or can we use through the GUI or can we use PowerShell? So today there is no PowerShell access for SharePoint Online. It is all done through the GUI. Or through SharePoint Designer if you want to connect in and start to do site creation through there. They are looking at PowerShell access at the moment. Currently, they didn't want to, again, make all those commandlets available to do a whole bunch of things that you don't want to do, or we don't want you to compromise the service. So they're looking at that, but at the moment, it's not there today.
The infrastructure is there. Actually, a lot of the admin is done through PowerShell. We don't expose it to you yet. So it will be coming in the future.
The question is, how do we know that what patches have been deployed to the online service? So the team constantly maintain patches and updates as part of that. You will be able to pull up the dev toolbar as you need to and see what has been applied on that from that perspective. But you'll also see in the Microsoft Online Administration Center, so the overall service admin center, we have a health dashboard, and that details any patches that are going through as part of that, so you'll be able to keep an eye on that come through. So you can subscribe to that as an RSS feed. Every time we do patches to the service, any of the services will put that in there and notify you of that as well. So you'll be able to keep a track on that as to what's gone through. Yep, so the question is around patching, do we give lead up and do we give notification on that? So any service updates we do, you know, around patching specifically, if we're looking at, you know, small security updates, we'll have a minimum 5-day lead time in regards to what we're doing there. Big service pack updates, service pack updates will go into a service update potential thing, which is part of our 90-day update cycle, and they get a much bigger lead time as part of that. So.
We have a service health dashboard that shows you service history as well as customer impacting scheduled events. So maintenance periods, things like that, they will be posted there and your tenant admin will see them.
So any more? I'm going to take one more SharePoint question if we've got one and then we'll move on to the link online. Cool.
All right. I'll just say one thing that we didn't talk about. Maximum storage for SharePoint Online is 5 terabytes. Okay, if you have a small number of users, you can buy the extra storage, or like Ben said, you get 500 megabytes allocated space per user in the license, but you can buy additional storage up to 5 terabytes per tenant. Okay, the service descriptions are really what you need to look at for limitations and specifics functionality for each type of each area within the service. Okay, there's service descriptions on the online environment. Go up to Microsoft.com, search Office 365 service description. You'll get them. You can download them. Please reference those. That's where all the detail is. And your sales team, Ben, will be using those to talk you through the sales process before you actually purchase.
I actually have a bit.ly URL on a later slide that you can use to get
Great.
Straight to those as well.
Okay, link online. I'm going to contrast this with on-premises and what's available on-premises versus online. Instant messenger, presence, and conferencing. Okay, those are really the primary functions of that you can get with the online version of Link. Okay. But on-premises, of course, you get it all. You can do whatever you want. You can replace your PBX in certain instances. You can integrate it with click to dial. And other cloud services so that you can have an experience like I do at Microsoft where, you know, I just click and call any number in the world and it just works. That's coming. PBX replacement, probably not coming for a long time. But the click to dial, the integration with other services will be coming in the next couple of years. So with IM and presence, you primarily get peer-to-peer and multi, that's conferencing, that's the next piece. You get peer-to-peer, IM and presence, file sharing, video, et cetera. It works very well. There are some limitations based on which country you're in. Okay, so some countries you can't have the multi-party conferencing. We will limit that. It's due to telecom rules and regulations within those countries. It's all well documented out on Microsoft.com. In the environment, so please, you know, take a look at that. Don't want you to be surprised. You get PC audio, video. You get your global address list as long as you're synchronized into the feedback.
Yeah.
Wayne, the feedback's still killing me, I think. So click to communicate with individuals. If you've got Link Online, Outlook Web Access, it's integrated. So the new 2010 Outlook Web Access, you can have your IM sessions right there. If you have both Exchange Online and Link Online, you go into OWA, you get that interface. It works really nicely. If you have Link on-premises and Exchange Online, then you don't get that integrated OWA experience. But you still can see, the clients will still see the presence information. And that was that Link web app for IM and presence. We will have mobile client in the future. So specifically, the Bez mobile client will work in the future, and Windows Mobile, et cetera. And on the roadmap is IM archiving. So if you're in a certain business that requires the archiving of your instant messaging, that will come in the future. It's not available today in Office 365. Okay, you can do that online, and you can pull that data off into some other archive service, but not online right now. So the conferencing piece of it, Link Online Conferencing is a replace for live meeting. It's a replacement for live meeting. Current customers can still use live meeting. If you go into Link Online or Link On Premises, then the conferencing integration is fantastic. And that's the way we're going with it for the product. Multi-party, remember my caveat on countries, so you get that capability. I think it's up to 250 users within a multi-party conference. It works quite well. That's audio, video, voice, etc.
I think just very quickly on that too, the other thing around the multi-party side of things, so Link is peer-to-peer, so if I'm messaging Mike directly, that is from me to him. Once we hit multi-party, we are then using the service to proctor that essentially, so it's becoming the management service for that conference. So when we're looking at latency and you're looking at networks, in those conference situations, it's something to take into account for that.
In reality, I mean, we use it all the time. If you're getting up into those large numbers, that's a rare event. You know, I work with sessions up to, typically the largest is about 30 people in one session. The voice is fantastic, and then some people will use video too. So on-premises, you know, obviously on-prem server, you can do all of it. You have all that functionality. There's a subset of it. I want to refer you back to the service description for real specifics.
Okay. Any questions around the Link side of things before we just quickly move into, yeah?
Yes, so the question is, does the audio video adjust itself based on bandwidth detection? Yes, so the quality will go up and down based on your bandwidth, and it works quite well. Question?
You mentioned that there was a future roadmap for a Link web app. Today, is there any type of Link integration to Outlook web app?
Yes. So yes. If you log on to Outlook, the Outlook web application in Exchange Online, you will get your contact list and all those kind of things show up as part of that. That is purely within Outlook. You need to be logged in there to do that. This future web app is a separate web app that you could go to and say, I just want to log on to the Link site and get my contacts and start up a conversation.
Okay.
Cool.
Thanks.
All right, so I'm going to very quickly now start to touch on Office Professional Plus and what some of the changes are around this. Now, when we look at Office 2010, as I said, it is Office. It is just the Office on the desktop. And I have 10 minutes, so I'm going to zoom through this as quickly as possible, and hopefully it'll cover everything you need to know. But it is Office on the desktop. It is Pro Plus, and you get everything you see here from the application perspective. So great way to ensure that your users are running the most recent copy of Office. Down here, we have the web apps. The web apps are part of, or they're built on SharePoint. How many people here know the difference between the web apps and the client? Okay, so let's just go over this, because there has been some confusion around what the web apps are and what the client is. The web apps are a complement to the Office 2010 client. They are not the full-blown replacement that you would simply go, I'm going to have everyone on web apps, and that means I don't have to deploy anything to the desktop. Okay, so what they provide is the ability for you to view a Word document online, be able to edit that Word document in essential editing, kind of do some changes to a paragraph or to some editing and save that directly back. It requires SharePoint. The document needs to be stored in SharePoint. Same with PowerPoint, OneNote, and Excel as well as part of that. The key thing here is that what this does provide is the ability to view those documents more quickly and easily. So let's take that 4,000-page spec document that you just want to update the first paragraph, render that in SharePoint Online in the web app or in the Word web application. You can then make that quick update. You haven't had to pull that entire document down to your desktop just to make that change. So this is really where they start to play really nicely. They are a complement. They are not a full replacement. And this is what's really key. Again, if you come to the Zero to Productivity session tomorrow morning, we will show you what the difference is between those web apps and that client as well as part of that. So I'm going to quickly come over here because we'll see what else we've got in here. So a couple of things around subscription side of things for this. So no more big 25-character product keys for Office when you're buying it from the Office 365 portal. You authenticate and activate that product with your Microsoft or your Office 365 ID. So basically you put in your online ID, you hit activate, and that activates against the online service. Checks your licensing there, make sure you're available to do that, and does that activation with that point. That does mean that there are a couple of tools here around the Office Subscription Agent and the Agent Notifier. What we provide is the ability for you to install Office and activate it on up to 5 PCs for a single person. These two tools here around the Subscription Agent and the Notifier will allow you to see what PCs that have been activated on, will allow you to see what, if you decide you kill a laptop and you get a new one, you want to put it on that one as well, you can then, axe one of those PCs out and activate it onto a new laptop as part of that. So the activation process overall, the way this works is, simply put, user goes to the portal and pulls down the Office Pro Plus installer. They install that. The subscription agent then talks to the subscription service. Now, the key thing here is that copy of Office that you pull down from the Office 365 portal is a special baked copy of Office to talk to Office 365. So if you decide to go and put an Office 2010 disk that you pulled from someone, you're not going to get that prompt that says, hey, talk to the cloud to get the activation. So you've got to make sure you have the actual right media as part of that, and specialist media to do that. Once that activation happens, it comes back down and does the activation to the software. Now, key thing around this activation is continuous. So in Office 2010, we had this concept of a KMS server. 5 minutes, we'll keep going here. KMS server, which would continually reactivate and make sure you're activated. Essentially, the cloud becomes this big KMS server for your users, just for those activations. So it'll continually recheck with that to do that activation as part of that. So that's where that really starts to change as part of that activation process. What do we got next on there? Very quickly, you can customize this. So if you are rolling this out as part of SCCM, you can use the OCT tool to pull that down, make customizations to the way that's deployed and installed to help simplify that and make that a little bit easier as well. So we'll click over. So I'm going to very quickly skip through this, and then we'll have questions. I've got about 2 minutes left, I'd say. So this is to answer your question specifically around what's the difference between Telstra and what's the difference between Microsoft. When we're looking at purchasing Office 365, there are two models to purchase. We have an exclusive partnership with Telstra. Telstra deal with anyone between that 1 to 250 licenses that doesn't have an enterprise agreement with Microsoft. So, for example, my father-in-law runs his own little business out of home, and he wants to go and buy Office 365. He goes to Telstra, and he buys it from Telstra. The benefits here are that he can buy one single license, he can buy it on a month-per-month basis, and he gets all the support and all these services as part of that. They become the billing arm for us. They're not running a data center locally. It's still hosted out of the Microsoft data center. They are just the shop front for that service. Now, if you have an EA, you're looking at working with Microsoft directly, you come to us. Differences here is it's a minimum 250 seats. We only sell the E-size plans, and we'll talk about what the difference are on EMP in our Zero to Productivity session. But essentially small business plan and enterprise plan, and there is a minimum 3-year contract as part of that. And all of the interaction between the customer consuming that is between us and them and Microsoft. There's no Telstra in between that. So does that answer your question? Yep, cool, beautiful. Okay, so very quickly, calls to actions, and I think this slide is wrong. Go to office365.com to get more info. The trial will actually direct you back through Telstra. But go to office365.com to get more info on that, and definitely check out this bit.ly link down here for the service description. So bit.ly 0365, that is an O, not a zero. 0365 SD will give you a list of all those service descriptions on the site as part of that. Follow-up sessions. So these are some of the sessions we've been talking about through today. OFC 309, Zero to Productivity, this is where we're going to set up this, a tenant in real time. The identity session is directly after this. Not sure of the room, but follow Mike in the purple shirt and you will definitely get there. And then later on today, the hybrid and simple migration, and then exploring the Office developer story later on this week. So part of that, thank you. Thank you for your questions throughout the session. I think we've just hit 1 minute. Done.
Thank you all for coming.